today. Let's see if I've got the right group. We've got Naquanago Baptist Academy. Those students, please stand. Thank you. These students are very intent on oral argument. This is the second one that they're attending, so you'll hear differences. And we had Elkhorn High School this morning. Are there Elkhorn High School students left now? Yes. Good. Well, welcome, and thank you for attending, and you too, at least attended part of the first hearing. And I want to say that today is our Deputy Marshal Jack Bagley's last oral argument. And he's standing in the back of the courtroom. And Mr. Bagley has been with the court for 18 years. And that may seem to some in the courtroom a long time and to others a short time. And in terms of service to the court, they've been a wonderful 18 years. Mr. Bagley, on behalf of the court, I want to thank you for your length of service and the nature of the service that has been so important to keep this court running and running smoothly. So we're going to miss you, but we wish you a long, healthy, and wonderful retirement, you and your wife. And I'm sure that you're going to come back and visit us. So thank you. Well, you've met the students and you've met Mr. Bagley, and I'd like to introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far right is Justice Diane Sykes. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Ann Walsh Bradley. And to her left is Justice David Prosser, and on the far left, Justice Patience Rogensack. Now, part of the Court with Class program, as you all know, with which the students are here, is to meet with a justice at noon to discuss the processes of the court, not the substance of either one of these cases. And so this noon, I will meet with the students. Anyone else in the courtroom, welcome to attend. It's not limited to the students. So with all of those introductory matters completed, we're going to turn to the case before us, 02-3314-D, in the matter of disciplinary proceedings against Michael G. Trewin, OLR, that's the Office of Lawyer Regulation, versus Trewin. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Trewin is Mark J. Steichen.
Yes, sir.
And then we'll have 30 minutes from Julie M. Falk of the Office of Lawyer Regulation, and then, Mr. Steichen, you will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. You may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Mark Steichen, and it's my privilege to represent the respondent, Michael G. Trewin. I only hope that I can do justice and come close to the quality of the argument that the students were able to hear in the first case this morning. I'd like to dispense with a statement of the facts. Obviously, they're too numerous in this case to do justice to them in 30 minutes, and I would welcome any questions that the court has on any of the issues. I'd like to make several points. The first goes to the integrity and character of Mr. Trewin. The evidence in the case came from Judge Shapiro, U.S. bankruptcy judge for the Eastern District of Wisconsin, who testified to Mr. Trewin's high competence in his field, primarily of secured creditors and bankruptcy work, and of his zealous advocacy for his clients. Judge Ray Huber, Circuit Judge of Waupaca County, testified that Mr. Trewin has a reputation in the Waupaca Bar for honesty and integrity, that when he says something, other attorneys can rely on it. David Balknick is a former employee of F&M Bank who has no personal affiliation with Mr. Trewin. He was involved in one of the transactions in which Mr. Trewin borrowed some money from F&M Bank in order to lend to David Scheider. He testified that while that was going on, Mr. Trewin exhibited concern that he was complying with the rules of evidence, the rules of ethics. My point is that Mr. Trewin is an honest, reputable attorney. He's not perfect. He has made some mistakes, and he has conceded those mistakes. We have some disputes over the interpretations of some of the rules of ethics, and I believe that Mr. Trewin's interpretation is not only reasonable, but should prevail. But if it doesn't, it's not because he knowingly violated the rules, but because he was trying in good faith to comply. And that's very important in a disciplinary proceeding. My second point is that the issues being raised on appeal are primarily over conclusions of law, not findings of fact. There are very few disputes of fact as found by the referee. However, we have some disputes with the conclusions of law drawn by the referee, particularly with respect to Rule 1.8A concerning transactions with clients. But the greater concern is the portion of the referee's report that is labeled discussion. And at the discussion point, the referee engages in a good deal of commentary that finds no analog in the findings of fact, and more importantly, has no basis in the record. And my comment here is that there's no shortcut in dealing with the numerous claims that have been brought to examining each claim upon the facts. Sweeping generalizations about conflicts of interest are not sufficient and not fair to Mr. Trewin. Nor can we rely on mere allegations or arguments that have been made. My third point is to urge the court, once the objections to costs have been filed, and they will be very specific, to closely scrutinize the costs that have been requested by OLR in this case for several reasons. One is that this case has been grossly overtried. There's been duplicative, unnecessary discovery. We have no problem with the rule that respondents who are found to have engaged in misconduct pay the reasonable costs of the proceeding. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about unreasonable costs. Assuming that all of the counts found by the referee are upheld, almost all of them involve facts that have been undisputed since the investigation stage. Mr. Trewin's responses in the investigation stage were extensive, detailed, and he provided substantial amounts of records along with them. And his positions and his concessions on those facts have been clear from the beginning. Facts such as he did not obtain separate written conflict waivers and provide written disclosures under Rule 1.8A because he didn't think that that was necessary. That's never been at issue. Facts such as the dates that transactions occurred, what disbursements were made and when, how interest was calculated and when he paid for his credit card bills, and so forth. Now, we disagree on the conclusions to be drawn from those facts, but those facts have been undisputed.
Well, didn't OLR have to find out about those facts? Didn't that take some digging?
We will not be objecting to the investigation.
We're not.
Pardon? We're not.
No.
We have no problem with the fact that grievances were filed, one on behalf of the Scheider estate and another apparently, it's not clear to us if there was a separate one, by Robert Lepak. Those grievances, when they're made, they made serious allegations. Those allegations certainly should and were investigated. The problem is what was then done with that. We think that the scope of the investigation was far too limited in many of the areas. There was no follow-up done when there was a grievance with allegations, a response by Mr. Trewin, and then a complaint filed. For example, this is particularly true in the case of Robert Lepak. We have diametrically opposed accounts of what happened. In short, Mr. Lepak says, I wanted a bankruptcy filed. Mr. Trewin waited until the last minute, pulled a fast one, said, I won't file it. You've got to sell this property to my brother-in-law. Basically, extortion. Mr. Trewin and his brother-in-law say, he came in, he did not want to file bankruptcy. He wanted to find a way around bankruptcy, and Mr. Trewin introduced him to his brother-in-law, and they negotiated a deal.
Isn't that in itself, just forgetting about anything else, isn't that in itself sort of a red flag when you have a client who has a problem financially and he doesn't want to go through bankruptcy, and so you prepare a warranty deed and transfer the ownership to your brother-in-law? Of all the people to have buy the property, there could have been a lot of other people beside the brother-in-law. I mean, that sort of raises a concern, wouldn't it, of just dealing? Isn't that sort of self-dealing?
Well,
I don't know all of the facts, and I've read, the file here, but that and the brother-in-law was involved in other transactions, too. I mean, when they bought the gas business from Chevalier and other things.
Let me take them in reverse order.
Okay.
When they purchased the assets of the propane company, Mr. Trewin was involved in that transaction. That raised a red flag, and what he did was to ensure that Mr. Chevalier, who was involved in that transaction, was separately represented by then-attorney Ray Huber. And there was a dispute. Mr. Chevalier acknowledged that in an affidavit. On the eve of the hearing, he recanted his entire affidavit. The referee found that that was not credible, that he had done that because of some close scrutiny that had occurred recently of some of his dealings as manager of that business, and he had a financial motive to now impugn Mr. Trewin. We had records showing that he was represented by Judge Huber. So that, yes, it raises a red flag, and that's how that was handled. The transaction with Mr. Lepak is a different situation because Mr. Trewin was not a party to that transaction. He acted as scrivener and then later acted as attorney for Mr. Lepak in some limited ways. He did not in any way act as an attorney or advisor for his brother-in-law. And Mr. Lepak, according to the testimony of both Mr. Trewin and Mr. Schomer, and their testimony was found to be credible, whereas Mr. Lepak's was not, was that Mr. Lepak was fully aware of the relationship. The proposal, it raises a red flag, and what do you have to do? You have to, if this were a transaction which came under Rule 1.8, and we have a summary judgment, it was found that it did not, because it was not a transaction with Mr. Trewin. You would need to have the terms in writing. All of those terms were in writing for Mr. Lepak to review. And what you need to understand is that Mr. Lepak is a former real estate broker. He has experience in real estate transactions. He writes his own real estate documents. He's an experienced pro se litigator. He has gone so far as to sue a judge and a policeman after he was convicted of drunk driving. So he's not a wallflower. He's not someone who is timid. He was also looking at the same exact type of transaction a month before he entered into the transaction with Mr. Schomer. It was with an out-of-state company, and that company declined to enter into a purchase and lease back because there wasn't sufficient time for them to do their due diligence. Does it raise some red flags? Yes, in the sense that often questions about whether there are ethical concerns arise, and we'll go to our fellow attorneys and say, well, you know, here's the situation. Does this come afoul of any ethical rules? Talk about it, and if not, you proceed. This didn't fall afoul of any ethics rules. The referee concluded that there was a violation of Rule 1.7A with respect to Mr. Lepak because he was under the impression that Mr. Trewin represented Mr. Schomer and Mr. Lepak jointly. We pointed out that that was not the case. There was no evidence in the record to that. In fact, all of the evidence was to the contrary. In the OLR's appeal brief, they make no mention of that, which I think means that they implicitly concede that fact. Instead, they try to argue it as a 1.7B violation, arguing without reference to any evidence whatsoever in the record that Mr. Trewin might have had some unspecified obligations to his brother-in-law.
Well, he wasn't, according to, I'm just reading at page 48 of the appeal from the referee's report, that he was not only the brother-in-law, but he was the business partner of Mr. Trewin. I'm talking about Mr. Schomer.
He was a co-owner of Menominee Gas Incorporated,
right,
which
had... That's why I brought that, yeah.
Right. That had nothing to do whatsoever with this transaction.
I understand that, but still there's that relationship of being a business partner. I mean, brother-in-law, business partner, and then third partner.
Well, there is, but that does not mean that there is an ethical problem under Rule 1.7B. If that were the case, is simply having some sort of relationship with another party were enough to require a conflict waiver, then every time that we dealt with an attorney whom we knew, perhaps we go to the club together, perhaps we have dinner together, we'd have to say, well, you have to understand that I'm negotiating with someone that I have some kind of relationship with. And where is the just stopping point?
Not trying to be argumentative, but there's a difference between a social friendship and a brother-in-law or a business partner. That's all I'm pointing out.
And if there were more to that, if there were something about the business relationship that gave Mr. Schomer some sort of pull on Mr. Trewin, that Mr. Trewin owed some kind of obligation to him that would somehow affect this transaction, then yes. But there's nothing whatsoever about that in this record. The argument in OLR's brief is purely speculation.
Counsel, I want to focus on your client's position that he was not aware of the prohibition regarding business transactions with clients. That prohibition, of course, is set forth in SCR 20.1.8, and we're talking about A, and then the requirement in 3 for the client's consent in writing there, too. And I want to focus on the matter involving Mr. Scheider. This is my concern. As I understand it, Scheider was having difficulty with funds, and over the course of time, your client loaned Scheider, who was his client, about $160,000, and that was secured with a note and a security interest, as I recall. Now, when Scheider was he going through bankruptcy? And this is what my concern is. As I understand it, Mr. Trewin, Attorney Trewin, then it looks like tried to hide the fact that he had these promissory notes and security interests because he transferred them to his brother-in-law so that he wouldn't be brought into the foreclosure action. And then as soon as the action was over with, he got them back. He got, you know, the what he had transferred temporarily to his brother-in-law. To me, that smells like, why did, you know, some kind of a camouflage attempt going on here. Why did he do this if he didn't think there was something improper? Can you respond to that?
Yes, I'd be happy to. And let me start, if I may, by addressing the premise of the Court's question, because I think it comes from a misstatement in, or maybe a misunderstanding by the referee. Mr. Trewin has never said that he was unfamiliar with the prohibition. It's not a prohibition, but that there are rules governing transactions with clients. He has never said that. In fact, in his statements from the time of the investigation, he has been clear that he was aware of them and was trying to comply with it. It's a matter of what Rule 1.8a requires. And the referee's report is written in such a way as to imply that here we have someone going through all these transactions without even being aware of the rule. That is simply not the case. We have a disagreement about what the plain language of the rule requires. He consistently put the transactions in writing. He gave his clients an opportunity to obtain independent counsel, and he obtained their consent to the terms of the transaction. That was his understanding of the plain language of the rule. Where we have disagreed with the referee is the argument that you must also put all risks that are possible of the transaction in writing and get a separate consent. Now, addressing the specifics, the problem is that all of these sort of smell bad when you look at them on a general level. And that's why it's critical to look at the sequence and to understand exactly what was happening. Now, in the bankruptcy, what happened, the relationship started in December of 1997 when Mr. Scheider was referred for a bankruptcy. A Chapter 12 bankruptcy was filed. That's a farm reorganization form of bankruptcy. Mr. Scheider couldn't make the payments that are required under that form. So then it was converted to a Chapter 7 bankruptcy. And under a Chapter 7 bankruptcy, you basically liquidate you can liquidate your assets, but the way it really works in farm practice is you discharge your unsecured debt, and then you make new arrangements with the secured creditors on, if you can meet arrangements, if you can make mutually agreeable arrangements. And that's really what was done. Now, that's when the first loan was made for $12,900 to pay off two judgments and the $400 bankruptcy fee. There's no conflict in representing him in the bankruptcy because those debts would have nothing to do with the bankruptcy which had been filed before that.
My focus really is on paragraph 40, page 8 of the findings of fact of the referee, where he says, after the foreclosure action was started, Trewin assigned his promissory notes and security interest to his brother-in-law, Schomer. The assignment was purely a ruse. Under its terms, Schomer had no real ownership and all interest earnings reverted to Midwest. Trewin's intent in entering into the assignment, as expressed in a memo to Schomer, Exhibit 46, and the assignment itself, was to avoid any possibility that he would be called to testify in the foreclosure action and therefore be prevented from representing Scheider under the rules of ethics dealing with lawyers as witnesses. At the conclusion of the foreclosure action, the loan was reassigned to Trewin, Midwest.
Right.
I read that, and it sounds to me like, oh, yeah, I'm trying to hide something. So can you explain
that? Yes, yes, and that's what I'd like to put in context. Now we fast forward. Mr. Scheider was trying to work out a reaffirmation with his primary creditor, Associated Bank. And when those arrangements were not coming together, Associated Bank filed a foreclosure action. At that point, Mr. Trewin had lent Mr. Scheider money to buy cattle.
And that was about 100 and...
That was 130?
6, I can't remember. It's 12%.
Right. It was, as I recall, $160,000 roughly, of which about 110 was for cattle, and then some were for feed and a few other things. Now, there was no disagreement between Mr. Trewin and Associated Bank's lawyer, William Grunewald, about the relative rights and priorities of Associated's and Mr. Trewin's rights. Mr. Trewin had a purchase money security interest in the cows. The bank had a security interest in everything except the cows, basically, because the cows had been purchased after the filing of the bankruptcy under the bankruptcy code. The lien doesn't attach to after acquired property. So there's no dispute about it. Mr. Trewin's concern was, well, what if something comes up where I need to testify about, you know, that, just to have it all straightened out? Rule 3.7 says that I can't act as both advocate and counselor, and I don't want to be in a situation that because of this, you know, fairly minor situation, that then Mr. Scheider has to go and get a new lawyer. And he put that reasoning in his memo to his brother-in-law and said, here, let me assign this to you, and you, you know, then are the nominal owner. No question that there's no consideration for it. You're the nominal owner, and then if we need testimony, you have personal knowledge. You will, you know, be familiar with the books and so forth. Did it have to be done that way? No. Might I have done it in a different way? Probably. But the question is, what was the reason for doing it? The reason, as found by the referee, was to avoid a problem with Rule 3.7, which has nothing to do with concealing it from anyone. Now, OLR argues in its brief that the motive was to hide something, to hide his ownership. Well, first of all, there's no evidence in the record to support that assertion. It is nothing but an assertion. But if you go beyond that, the question would be, why would you hide it? There must have been a reason, if you were going to hide it, for doing so. The fact is that it didn't matter whose name was on those security interests, whether it was Schomer, whether it was Midwest Incorporated, or whether it was Trewin. They were either going to survive the foreclosure action, or they weren't, depending upon the priorities that they have under the law. And there was no dispute about that. Now, the purchase money security interest, if Mr. Trewin had said, hey, it's owned by Midwest Comics, but I'm the owner of Midwest Comics, and they were brought in as, he was brought in as a defendant, what would that have done to his purchase money security interest? Nothing. Nothing whatsoever. Because, as William Grunewald acknowledged, the bank had no security interest in it. What did Mr. Trewin, in fact, do as part of the negotiations in that foreclosure action? He said, if you will extend your financing, if you will make a deal, because here's what would happen if he didn't. The bank would take all the personal property from the farm, and basically Mr. Scheider would have been out of business. There would have been a year's redemption on the real estate, which would have been earning no money. That doesn't make any sense. Mr. Trewin said, if you will extend your financing for another year. I will subordinate my interest in the cattle to you. He got nothing in return for that. He gave up his first priority interest in $100,000 worth of cows for Mr. Scheider's benefit, with no return whatsoever for him. Now, if he was intending to conceal his interest, why would he do it in the first place? And then why would he agree to subordinate his interest? He acted throughout his representation of Mr. Scheider in a way that was to Mr. Scheider's advantage. I see my time is up.
Counsel, your conclusion in your brief says that you ask the court to dismiss all counts except those that your client has conceded.
That's correct.
And that a sanction appropriate to those counts be imposed, taking into account the mitigating factor. So what do you think is the appropriate sanction?
Well, I think the appropriate sanction, applying the ABA standards, would be actually what they call an admonition and what we call a private reprimand. However, for Mr. Trewin, there's not a lot of difference at this point between a private and a public reprimand. And in fact, a public reprimand is probably better so that all of the council who know, in, you know, particularly Waupaca County and the surrounding area, who know that all these charges have been brought, will then know what he's actually been found guilty of and what he hasn't. So I think that would be an appropriate sanction, and then I think the court ought to look at the costs and reduce the costs that were, A, unnecessary, and, B, that were for counts that were not found against him, and reduce those costs by the amount of unnecessary expense that he was put to for allegations that should never have been brought.
You're going to get a chance to rebuttal. Could you, when you look at those costs, when you come back, could you just show us those unnecessary areas and what costs should be deleted? Thank you.
And you asked for more time, I believe it was you, to answer as to costs. And the OLR filed costs earlier than it generally does in this case, so you will be given an opportunity to write something on that. You to do as best you can.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Falk, representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation. Which one? The top one.
May it please the Court, my name is Julie Falk, and I represent the Office of Lawyer Regulation in the present disciplinary proceeding. Trewin attempts to belittle his misconduct as minor and insignificant in this case. However, the amount of money that Trewin has loaned his clients and the number of business transactions he has entered into with his clients is well beyond the ordinary. The referee found that the frequency and magnitude of the loans and business transactions that Trewin entered into with his clients appeared to be a common occurrence in his practice of law, that he appeared to be more of a banker than a lawyer. Since 1996, Trewin has loaned money to at least 9 clients, totaling approximately $700,000. He has also purchased at least 3 of his clients' properties, entered into lease or sale-back transactions with those clients when he represented those clients in the respective foreclosure and bankruptcy proceedings. Trewin has benefited by these transactions.
Financially benefited?
Pardon me?
Did you say that he benefited? Was that financially?
Yes. He benefited. By these transactions, he received interest on these transactions, also received points on these transactions.
What, you mean points off his credit card?
He charged points up front on the loans to the loans with his clients. He also charged his clients for drafting the transactional documents related to the loans and the real estate transactions.
Counselor, is there anything in the rules that prevents him from benefiting on transactions with clients?
There's nothing in the rules that prevents him from benefiting on these transactions with clients. The problem is that he engaged in business transactions with his clients in violation of the rules.
Well, there isn't anything in the rule that is an absolute prohibition in that regard either, correct?
No, the rules are prohibitory in that they do prohibit business transactions with a client unless the attorney make sure that they follow the specific requirements of the rule.
Right. So the rules are not absolute about business transactions, and there's nothing in the rule at all about his benefiting and that being a violation of the rule, correct?
That's correct, as long as he follows the essential requirements of the rule.
I'd like you to look at a little bit at Section 1.8A. It seems to be a source of contention with Mr. Trewin in that he believes he followed that rule, was aware of it, tried to follow it in good faith, and OLR believes that that was not the case because of certain conditions they put on the rule about a writing disclosing all of the potential conflicts.
Correct.
Okay, I've read the rule, and there's nothing in the rule that says in words what you're asking us to conclude as a matter of law. Can you tell me how I'm supposed to get to where you want us to go?
Well, if you review the rule is in regards to entering into business transactions
right,
with the
right.
client. It's headed business transactions yep. with the client. It says you can't enter into a business transaction with a client unless you meet steps 1, 2, and 3, essentially.
Correct. Right. That's right.
And number 3 is a client consents in writing thereto.
Right.
Now, it doesn't specifically state what the client consents to, but I believe that this court can infer from that language that the client has to consent to this business transaction with
right.
the attorney, including all the risks and conflicts.
Now that's the part where I think you two differ. I think that he agrees there has to be a consent in writing to the business transaction. Certainly you have the documents. He signed all the documents. And there were oral statements that I think are not in contest, that he informed the clients they could look at another lawyer and so forth. The contention seems to be what the conflicts of interest might be an OLR statement that has to be in writing. And
right.
I don't see that in the rule. I have concerns about notice, frankly. That's what's bothering me.
Well, first of all, this court has in the past, in case law, stated specifically that the rule, whether it be the old rule 20.27 or the new rule SCR 20:1.8A, requires more than consent to the transactional documents. This court has stated this in the Ken Hur case,
mm-hmm.
which this court stated that full and adequate disclosure to the client concerning their differing, competing, and adverse interests is what the court has meant by informed client consent to a business transaction.
Does Ken Hur say it has to be in writing?
Now, under the old rule, it was not required to be in writing. Under the new rule, SCR 20:1.8A, it does require that it be in writing.
Where is that language? Can you find
the client consents in writing there too? Number 3.
The business transaction. But what
the conflict of entering into a business transaction with an
attorney.
It doesn't
say anything about conflict in the rule. It
well,
says
the rule,
there too, and there's nothing in the rule that uses conflict. Right?
But the rule is addressing a business transaction with the attorney,
right.
and the purpose behind the rule and the reason that an attorney has to comply with these requirements is to prevent overreaching by an attorney.
Right, and I understand, and I think your version of the rule may be the better version. I mean, maybe we need to amend our rule. I'm looking at it from someone's perspective who knew about the rule, who read the rule, and came up with a different conclusion than you did. And as I said, it's not that I disagree with what you're saying. It sounds like a fine policy. My concern is with notice.
Well, this court, as I said, in the past decisions had said consent includes more than just the transactional documents. In Jacobs, this court said that full disclosure is not merely providing the client with the transactional documents. You have to explain the conflicts of entering into a business transaction with an attorney. Now, the ABA model rule, which this court has traditionally followed did clarify the rule to add an attorney's role to address the issue of confusion.
Right, right. And I saw that. That was helpful for you to point that out. My concern is, as I said to you. Thank you.
Sure. I mean, in client consent, in this type of transaction would include discussing the material risks of the proposed transaction with the attorney, discussing any risks presented by the attorney's involvement, including that the attorney's financial or personal interests in that transaction may adversely affect the advice that that attorney is providing to the client concerning that transaction.
May I ask you on that 20.18 A.
Yes.
Are there any complaints that 1A1 was violated?
OLR has alleged that the transaction was unfair and unreasonable, and the referee found that it was unreasonable with regard to Trewin's predating of interest on the loan accountings that he essentially then presented to the estate of David Scheider. So in that respect, the OLR is alleging that those terms were unreasonable. The OLR also alleged with regard to credit card transactions, the whole agreement has to be disclosed and transmitted to the client in writing. Trewin had a setup with David Scheider where he could take Trewin's credit cards to Harmony Co-op and buy supplies. Nothing was specifically set forth in writing as to the terms of Scheider being allowed to use those credit cards. And the documents in this case and the exhibit show that Trewin inconsistently applied when the interest would accrue on those credit card charges, which the OLR alleged was unreasonable and unfair to the client. If Trewin had something specifically set forth in writing that Scheider agreed to, stating, I will charge you for the charge you interest for the credit card charges on the date that you actually buy the payments at Harmony Co-op, OLR wouldn't be alleging a violation of 1.8A1.
How about 1.8A2?
OLR, Mr. Trewin has testified that he gave his clients verbally the right to seek counsel. There are clients that dispute this, that testified that Trewin did not orally advise them of the right to seek counsel. Arnold Chevalier testified that Trewin did not do that. Robert Leekpack testified that Trewin never advised him of the right to seek independent counsel. And also, Trewin presented in his briefs on appeal some affidavits that he had submitted on summary judgment where the clients state specifically that Trewin did comply orally with the requirements of the rule. However, Mr. Hurley, who is an affidavit that he does cite to in the record on R-17, disputes that, and although he did originally file an affidavit stating that Trewin complied with the rules, he subsequently stated that Trewin told him he needed to sign this affidavit. He didn't review the affidavit. He didn't understand it, and actually Trewin didn't comply with the requirements of the rule, didn't advise him to seek the advice of independent counsel. He indicated that for two of the loans that Trewin had with Mr. Hurley, he called him up on the phone and never received any documentation of those loans or even signed the loans relating to the phone calls. He also indicated that Trewin did not explain to him the risks or conflicts in entering into a loan transaction. So there is some dispute, and at least with some of the clients, he did not give them the reasonable opportunity to seek seek counsel.
Did the referee find violations of subsection 2?
He did not find violations specifically with regard to subsection 2, no.
But you say he did find violations of subsection 1.
Yes, he did. And he also then found violations of subsection 3 for Trewin's failure to fully explain the conflicts.
Has Mr. Trewin conceded certain violations of subsection 1?
No, he has not. The only concession with regard to the business transactions, based upon what this, how this court interprets the rule, is that he didn't provide a separate written waiver that his client signed, agreeing to entering into a transaction with their attorney.
Who got hurt here?
Well, there are a few clients that allege that they got hurt. There's no discernible harm here. We can't place a monetary number on the harm here. But Mr. Lepak alleges that he was harmed. He alleges that he feels he was deceived by Mr. Trewin.
This is the witness that had the credibility problems, according to the referee. Is that not right?
He found his testimony less than credible. But
I think we should perhaps set him aside.
We're
required to defer to the referee's credibility judgment.
Correct,
so we should set him aside in terms of how he feels in a subjective way.
There's no findings by the referee, period, of whether or not any client was harmed. But I can say that Mr. Chevalier and Mr. Lepak both had a similar story of coming to Trewin in financial distress with a deadline set to obtain back their property or their businesses. Ray Huber, the Judge Ray Huber, who testified in this case, said that Chevalier was at a point where he would have done anything to save his business. Mr. Lepak testified he was in the same situation. Kim Scheider testified that his father was dying of cancer, had farmed all his life, and wanted to preserve his farm and try to build up the equity in the farm to sell it so that he could inherit that farm to his children. And all three of these witnesses testified that they felt deceived, that Trewin came in a time when they were in financial despair, that he took their property from them, and that they feel that they were harmed by this conduct. And also the potential for harm with regard to other clients is there also in respect to these same scenarios. Just because two clients came in and they were extremely happy with what Trewin did for them and they think he's the greatest attorney on earth because they saved them. But there are clients out there that do feel harmed. And the potential for harm to those clients who come to Trewin in desperate financial situations, and when he comes in and he enters into adverse relationships with these clients, there is the potential that other clients were or could be harmed.
What's in this for Mr. Trewin? He's lending substantial sums of money to people who are in desperate financial straits. Means there's a high likelihood they're not going to be able to repay it. Why is he doing this? Is it for the goodness of his heart that he's Robin Hood?
And he does profit from these loans with his clients. He receives money in the form of interest payments and points, and mostly
he's paying interest to the bank because he's borrowing the money too.
But less interest than what he's loaning. What his loans are to his clients. So he is obtaining a profit by entering into these business transactions with his clients.
Is he taking a risk? I mean, is there enough equity that he has so that if they don't pay him that he's secure?
He does obtain equity in the loans with his clients. He's obtained mortgages in the loans with his clients. I can't say in every single instance he has. But, for example, with regard to Scheider, he had a mortgage on Scheider's property. He had a purchase money security interest in his cattle, and he also had a security interest in Scheider's personal property. And he did end up receiving money after Scheider was deceased. And he did earn a profit with regard to the loans to David Scheider.
Could I ask, when does OLR begin to assess costs in a case?
The OLR, according to the rule, pays for all the costs of the disciplinary proceeding. Costs begin to essentially be assessed once it goes to counsel in the case. So once counsel takes over and starts working on the file, then the costs start accruing. OLR does not ask for any costs associated with the investigation. OLR does not ask for any costs even during the litigation with regard to any counsel that may confer with anyone else within the OLR. For example, if we have retained counsel, if they call one of the attorneys at the OLR, they wouldn't be charged double for that time. But if in regards to the costs, the OLR, under the court's rule, submits a statement of costs with regard to the costs that the OLR has paid out as a result of the disciplinary proceeding. Under 2224, this court may assess all or a portion of the costs of the disciplinary proceeding. It's within this court's discretion to do so.
Counselor, is one of the bases on which we should exercise that discretion about whether to award all or some of the costs the allegation of overtrial that's been made here? In other words, there's been a statement by Mr. Trewin that there were statements in the pleadings that OLR knew after its investigation were not accurate, and that they really just threw the book at him rather than, after their investigation, selecting those issues that were really worthy of bringing to trial.
Well, first, in answer to your question, if an attorney legitimately has arguments that there was over-litigation or there was frivolous charges, then I believe there's room for the court to apportion costs. Mm-hmm. And I believe that this court has left it open. However, any claims in this case of frivolousness or over litigation is without merit. The referee was asked in pretrial motions to find that the OLR had filed frivolous claims and to find that the OLR over litigated case, and the referee declined to do so. I mean, in regards to this case, we're talking about a very complicated case. Both factually, even if the facts were undisputed, and legally. Factually, we're talking about 11 business transactions with clients. Although there was an investigation before it went to OLR counsel, I mean, it took a substantial amount of time to review all the documents that were presented. There were still documents that needed to be presented during discovery with regard to those transactions that the OLR had not yet obtained. And it took a substantial amount of time to sort through and really get a good grip on all the business transactions and the facts surrounding those business transactions.
How many depositions were taken, if you know, in these cases, this case?
There were three depositions that were taken up in Marshfield and Medford that were noticed by Mr. Trewin in this case. There was a telephone deposition of an attorney that was noticed by Trewin in this case. The OLR noticed the deposition of Trewin and his brother-in-law. And then there was the deposition of Robert Lepak, which was noticed by Trewin in this case.
Judge Huber testified, or did he have his deposition taken?
He did not have his deposition taken.
That was at trial.
Correct. And
so according to this, 3, 4, 5 depositions, either in person or by telephone, were noticed by Mr. Trewin, and one by you?
Two were noticed by the OLR. Okay. Of Mr. Trewin and Mr. Schomer.
Right, I'm sorry.
Mr. Trewin has a right to contest and dispute the allegations that have been brought by the Office of Lawyer Regulation. But most of the litigation in this matter was directly responsive to Trewin vigorously defending the allegations of misconduct in this case. Trewin filed a very substantial motion for summary judgment in this matter, which required the OLR to defend each and every claim that the OLR had against all 11 of the clients he entered into business transactions with. Trewin filed pretrial motions regarding frivolousness and over-litigation. He filed some motions in limine that the OLR needed to respond to, and he's also filed this appeal. There was a substantial amount of motions brought and a substantial amount of depositions called in this case that needed to be responded to.
Counsel, I'd like you to change your focus a little bit and look for me at section 28.4C. In regard to the assertion that issue preclusion should bar anything further on this, and the issue preclusion would be the judgment that Mr. Treewen received and was affirmed by the Court of Appeals on the action between the estate and him. Can you comment on why we ought not apply issue preclusion to that claim?
Well, because the issue of whether or not Treewen predated interest on loan accountings in violation of an ethical rule was never addressed by a previous court in this case. And the problem here is with regard to the OLR's allegations with those loan accountings. The loan accountings were presented to the estate of David Schneider initially, and then they were presented and also presented to the OLR. Discrepancies in those loan accountings were not noticed until after the OLR began its investigation. Now, Treewen then submitted a revised loan accounting correcting some of those errors, which was then finally submitted to the estate. And judgment with regard to the estate, in my understanding, was based primarily on the revisions that were already made. OLR's contention with regard to the errors on the loan accounting was for the initial errors in the initial loan accounting that Treewen submitted to the estate.
Okay, so the judgment that is out there includes the corrections that you thought should have been made initially, not subsequently.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. The purpose behind SCR 1.8A is to prevent overreaching by an attorney who is involved in a fiduciary relationship with his clients and owes a duty of loyalty to his clients. That duty of loyalty encompasses that the attorney provide his or her clients with unbiased, independent advice. Anytime an attorney enters into a business transaction with their client, a potential arises for that duty of loyalty to be breached. Attorney is not in the same position as a banker or an investor. Because of the attorney's fiduciary relationship with their client, the attorney is subject to stricter standards and greater scrutiny. If an attorney is going to enter into a business transaction with their client, an attorney has the burden to make sure that the entire agreement is fully disclosed and transmitted to the client in writing, must make sure that the terms are fair and reasonable to that client, and must make sure that the client is clearly aware of the conflicts and risks of entering into a business transaction with their attorney. Attorneys are in a position of great influence over their clients, especially when we are talking about clients that are coming to Treewen under serious financial distress, who will do anything to keep their farms and businesses. Clients, often with an attorney's encouragement, will come to trust that attorney and expect that the attorney will do what's in the client's interest and not the attorney's. The client will likely depend on the attorney's integrity, fairness, superior knowledge, and judgment in advising on those business transactions with the attorney. Under these circumstances, the exploitation or the potential for exploitation is great. Further, the attorney acquires confidential information from the client. An attorney can use that confidential information to the attorney's advantage in entering into business transactions with their clients. A conflict in entering into a business transaction with a client arises because the advice that best serves the client may not be the advice that best serves the attorney's interests. Attorneys get involved in conflict situations because they fail to recognize the divergence between their interests and the interests of their clients. They may believe that they won't succumb to temptation or that they will be able to exercise their own professional judgment and that they won't diminish their loyalty to the client and that they won't use improper information. But the potential for the attorney structuring the transaction to their interest is great. Informed consent requires disclosure of the lawyer's interest and the effect it will have on their professional judgment. Here, Truwin violated the rules by, one, failing to recognize the potential for conflict in entering into these business transactions with his clients, by failing to explain the potential for conflict, explaining to his clients that he does have personal and financial interests in these transactions that may affect his advice to them, and obtain their written consent. Contrary to his assertions, he did not in good faith and in a consistent fashion comply with the plain language of the rule. There was a potential for harm out there. Clients alleged they were harmed. And the OLR would ask that the court find that the findings of fact of the referee are not clearly erroneous, that this court accept the referee's findings, legal conclusions with regard to the misconduct, and that this court impose a sanction commensurate with the severity of Truwin's misconduct. Any questions?
Thank you, Ms. Falk. Mr. Steichen.
I want to get to the question that was posed to me earlier, but first I'd like to address, I think, what is a very important point. There was a comment made, and I'm not assuming that it was something that was anything other than a comment, but the comment was that the fact that Mr. Truwin's clients had gone through bankruptcy meant that there was a high likelihood that they wouldn't be able to repay him. That's an assumption. Please, please don't come to this with assumptions and look closely at the facts. Let me give you an example of why that's not the case. Many of these people came and they were over their heads in debt, and they went through a Chapter 7 bankruptcy, which then discharged their unsecured debt. Take the example of the Phillips. They also had a secured debt for their house. The prior bankruptcy attorney, before they came to Mr. Truwin, had them enter into a reaffirmation agreement for the $80,000 value of the loan that they had, even though the market value of the house was only about $50,000. Now, Mr. Truwin knew that that was crazy, that with a certain risk, what is customarily done is to say, fine, secured creditor, take your property back, and sell it. And what will they get? Certainly no more than the fair market value. So he told the Phillips, go find a lending institution, some friends, family, someone who would be willing to bid at the foreclosure sale. Revoke your reaffirmation. They went out and they couldn't find anyone. And most of Mr. Truwin's clients, if they can find someone, they do. He, in every single one of these cases, was the lender of last resort. They said, well, we can't find anyone. Would you do it? He explained to them the risks, which included that if they let it go to foreclosure sale, they may not get it. Someone else may outbid them. And they had an agreement that he would buy it, and then he would lease it back, or I can't recall if it was a lease back or a land contract, for a specified price, all of which was arranged in advance in writing. He bought it back for approximately $50,000, sold it to them. I think he made about $3,000 on the transaction. They lowered their debt on their house by about $30,000. Their monthly payments went down by $300. They were in a better position to be able to pay their mortgage because of this transaction. Now, It's important whenever you have this kind of transaction with a client to comply with the rules. Put it in writing so that there's no dispute about what the terms are. Give them an opportunity to get independent review. Have them sign those documents. It may also be a good idea to require additional safeguards, and that's what the ABA has done. It's amended the rule, and we're not saying that that wouldn't be a good thing for this court to do. That wasn't part of the rule as it exists. What should Mr. Trewin have done? Sorry, I don't want to stick my neck out. I don't want to take any risk. You're stuck. And if you look time after time after time, that's the situation. Why did he do it? Frankly, I think most of us would say, no thanks. Even though what we're doing is entirely proper, we don't want to put up with the risk that if anything goes wrong, we're going to be here. And Mr. Trewin was willing to do that. Why? Because it's the nature of the people that he deals with. Many of these people are good people. They're trying to make their way. They come out of bankruptcy and they have zero credit. Beth Johnson wanted to buy a car coming right out of bankruptcy. She could do it if she wanted to pay the dealer 24% interest and pay the price that the dealer wanted for the car. Mr. Trewin said, you know, that's crazy. Have someone else finance it. Couldn't find anyone. Mr. Trewin offered to sell his car to her. She didn't want to do that. No problem. You go pick out the car. He lent her money at 12%. And a car loan, car is not much security for a loan like that. And on and on and on. There has been no harm to any client in this case. I think the fact that OLR comes back and points to Robert Lepak and Mr. Chevalier as examples is insulting. Mr. Lepak is a con man who is trying to evade the debt that he agreed to enter into, a very fair transaction. And he's very experienced at doing it, and he knows how to do it. And the findings were that they were not credible.
Could I ask you quickly, did the referee find violations of 218A1?
He did with respect to several accounting errors. And with respect to that, the timing is that this proceeding came about. Mr. Scheider died in December of 2000. The estate continued to make payments for 3 months. Then it retained the services of Joe Norby. Joe Norby came in, told the estate, stop making payments, and then filed the grievance, and then used this grievance throughout the proceeding as leverage. His position in the lawsuit was, we shouldn't have to pay any of this money back, even though it was undisputed that Mr. Trewin had borrowed some $300,000 and had then Mr. Scheider used that to pay off his debt to Associated and had bought cattle and had paid off judgments and all these other things. They took the position, you violated the ethics rules, you pay nothing, and made a lot of allegations in that lawsuit, couldn't even put up enough evidence to survive a summary judgment motion, and then the judgment was summarily affirmed on appeal. Now,
so was there ever any statement made by the counsel for the estate that if Mr. Trewin didn't get off his demand for the interest, that there would be a complaint filed with us?
The complaint was filed before there was any discussion about it. It was complaint filed, and then there were discussions after that, basically saying, at one point he came up to saying, I'll pay you $50,000 for all of this borrowing. And the circuit court said, you're crazy. And they couldn't back up any of the many allegations that were made.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, I didn't get to the issue of...
Well, I have a question about the costs. In your briefs, you say that Mr. Trewin has been subjected to a high cost and he has got a lot of debt, and that you estimate your fees at about $35,000, and I don't
quite know where it starts or stops. But in light of the fact that your fees are about $35,000, why do you think that OLR is excessive at, what was it, $25,000?
Because we have to look at what costs were incurred for what purposes. Let me give you two examples, if I may. One, there was an allegation in counts 1, 6, 7, and 11. Unfair, substantively unfair transactions because his promissory notes included what's called a deemed insecure clause. So I sent a contention interrogatory, and I said, what's your basis for that? Who are your witnesses for that? And they responded, William Grunewald, the attorney for Associated Bank, and Tim Hovery, the banker for Associated Bank. So I said, fine. Notice their depositions. We go up to, I guess it was Marshfield and Medford. We spent about 10 to 15 hours on the road that day. We also did Kim Scheider's deposition. We got there, and they had no opinions that this was unreasonable. They hadn't even been asked to issue opinions about whether it was unreasonable. In fact, Mr. Grunewald said, well, you know, these are typical. These are in the Wisconsin Bankers Association forms. Not every promissory note contains them, but the promissory note that Mr. Trewin signed to F&M Bank did. Now, we still had to move for summary judgment to get that ruled out of the case. On appeal, OLR says, well, once we found out that there really wasn't anything behind that, then we dropped it. That's not the case, and the people that they found that out from, aside from us, were their own witnesses. Now, why should Mr. Trewin have to pay for OLR's costs of us going up and spending an entire day, plus the transcript costs, to find out that their witnesses didn't support their allegations? In fact, why shouldn't OLR pay Mr. Trewin's costs of doing that? And this, just if I may, one other brief example. On the issue of whether or not Mr. Trewin had ever required or obtained signed written conflict waivers for the transactions. He said in his responses to the investigation, I never did that because I didn't think they were needed. Then we have a 48-page complaint alleging that throughout. We admitted that throughout in the answer. Then we were served with requests for admissions, some 90-some paragraphs of requests for admissions, asking us to admit that. So we did again. Then Mr. Trewin's deposition was taken, and I seem to recall it going about 3 hours or so, and he was asked, did you ever require conflict of interest waivers? And went through all these different transactions. And he said, no, I didn't, and this is why. Now, we could have handled this with a stipulation. I'll concede that they have the option of putting it in the complaint. But once we admitted it in the answer, why all the additional discovery?
Did you offer a stipulation?
I had some discussions before the complaint was filed and was told that there wasn't going to be anything happening in the way of negotiations other than a complaint. After the complaint was filed and we answered it, there's no need for a stipulation. And then even after they were granted summary judgment, when we go to trial, a good portion of his time on the stand was going over the same allegations. I don't understand it. It was unnecessary, and those costs, I think, are unreasonable. So I will be looking, you know, I will be going through on a day-by-day basis and indicating specifically which costs we think are unnecessary, excessive, were not attributed to accounts that were successful, and areas that Mr. Trewin then should not have incurred.
And I assume OLR will respond to that. Thank you very much, Mr. Steichen, for your defense this morning, and thank you, Ms. Falk, for representing the OLR. That concludes our hearing on 02-3314-D. In the matter of disciplinary proceedings against Michael G. Trewin, OLR versus Trewin. And I will be out to speak with students, and the court will reconvene for its final oral argument at 1:30. We are in recess.